Good evening. At this time, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW. A lot of things we call the TechNet. Its major purpose, if you haven't already heard that, is a little bit of education. A group of people gather here to help each other understand how wireless equipment works, how to get more fun out of it, and how to make it work better. That's the main purpose. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins this time? Please give me your call letters and name, and that word yes, K2RIW.
M2EO, Richard, yes.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
QA, Greg, and yes.
K2DDV, Laura, no questions.
And WA2CDL, I'm just listening in right now. May have a couple of questions later on, Dick.
Good evening, all. This is K2KY.
So far, we've got Mel, Rich, Steve, Greg, Laura, Andy. Greg, your call letter's been called up. Please give us your call letters again.
QQA.
Okay, I heard QQA. What came in front of that? Greg, you're going to have to press your mic, wait a second or two, and then start talking to us. Please give us your full set of call letters, Greg.
QC2QQA. QLO Charlie 2. Quebec, Quebec Alpha.
WA2LAY Joe, checking in. No questions right now.
Okay, Joe, we got you in. No for now, but I'll bet you and Andy are going to have some questions as we proceed. Is there anyone else to check in? Okay, Paul recognized. Had my machine set the wrong way here. Let's start off with Rich, N2EO. What would you like to talk about tonight, Rich? And how are things in Whitestone?
Hey, Dick, we'll say good evening. And here we go. I don't think we're in the net mode. I hear a beep there, so I guess we'll have to leave a little pause. I'm going to request this to Mel. Mel, you know I've been looking for a water rejection tuner for the Collins KWM2A, and I found one today. I got a call on the telephone from, WCTA in Pennsylvania. He called me and told me there was one coming up on the Collins Selective Net Swapper Shop. It's a water model 337A. 337. Not a 340, not a 340A, but a 337. I tried to pull it up on Google, I can find no information on it. I'm wondering if you know what the difference is. It's not the one that mounts above the band switch where you have to drill a hole, because I did find some reference to it mounting in a KWM2A where that spot is taken up. Do you have any information on the water 337 down there? And do we know?
You know, Rick, are you sure it's a 337? Because I don't recall that number. It doesn't even ring a bell. I've never heard that one, I don't think. You'd have to really find if that was a production run or just an abnormal, you know, something with a prototype over.
I found the reference to it on the Collins Collectors Association on the forum. Somebody said he's looking, like I'm looking, he's looking for an instruction sheet. He's got one in a KWM2A, and he also said 337. So I don't know. This is coming from Texas. I was told by Hal, K16, he said it was 75 bucks. He said, don't even hesitate for that kind of money, because they usually go for a lot more than that on the used market. So I don't know. Like I say, I've seen some where they mount in the spot where you would normally put the second fan switch for a KWM-2A to switch the crystal bank. But it's not that, so I don't know.
Oh, I know. I remember 338, 339, 340. But the 337, you know, you really have the throne this time, Rich, because I don't remember it being the common. Yeah, I remember, I can tell you, the 338, I think, was the popular series on that. So who knows? Gee, I guess they most likely flipped something that I'm not familiar with, over.
Okay, now, what were the differences in the 338, the 340, and the 348? Today, my concern is I don't want to drill a hole in the rig and destroy its intrinsic value. Do all these units mount with concentric control on the function switch?
Yeah, basically, that was the whole idea, was an add-on. 338, really, I don't remember what was there. Something with the 337. I don't remember if they went into a production or for some reason dropped from production. The 338 was touted as excellent because of the type of contact. The switching contacts were very positive. Now, was it the 337? You know, you may be right that the 337, I think, had some issues about the band switching. What was it? Is that, maybe I'm wrong. You know, I'd have to think this out. But I remember the 338, I believe, was the standard that they all were looking for at the time. But possible that the 337 were modified, because I think there were issues basically with the switching in anything previous, Rich, over.
No, I don't know. Like I say, I tried Googling it, and everything is on the internet. I can't seem to pull anything up on that particular unit on the internet. So I don't know. It's going to be a surprise package, but not a lot of money, so hopefully it'll work out. Let me turn it back to you, Dick. KQRIW, TechNet, Limelock. Now, if you come up with any information, let me know, please. I'm going to need a manual. He does not have a manual. He said it's complete. Everything is there. It's a pull from the radio, but everything is complete. Take back to you, KQRIW, TechNet, Limelock, and 2EO.
I was waiting for the beep. Okay, good luck with that. Collins Project, Rich. Next person who signed in was Steve, KC2 Mike Delta Papa. And Steve, how's Baldwin treating you? KQLIW in the second half.
Very good, Dick. Baldwin's treating me pretty good. I'd like to say good evening to everyone out there on the net tonight. Dick, I know this isn't exactly your forte, but I know you're a pretty smart guy, and we got a lot of smart guys on the net tonight. This question concerns computing. I was wondering, you know, this question's always popped up in my head from time to time. Why are they still using, like, you know, the old traditional hard drive and computer, you know, the mechanical disk, you know, based up, as opposed to the, you know, the new drives, you know, the electronic drives, you know, you're seeing, like, the iPods, digital cameras, everything else like that. Is there some advantage to using the old mechanical hard drive, or is it, you know, just something that, you know, they hope will fail to be well fine with? But that seems to be like one of the common problems with computers. You know, it's either the power supply or the hard drive that fails. I was just curious, why don't they, you know, make a machine that, you know, has like one flash memory card in it or whatever. Back to you, Dave.
Good question, Steve. I think in the beginning, the purely solid-state hard drive equivalents were a little on the expensive side. When it comes to the read-write speed, I don't think that's a problem. When it comes to total capacity, I don't think that's a problem. There are a number of laptop computers you can buy now
which do have solid-state hard drives. In other words, no mechanical motion takes place. And I think they're a little bit pricey. Let me turn it over to the net, because I guarantee there's some computer-savvy people here. So let's see if they can tell us why solid-state hard drives are not already more popular. What's the major advantage that a rotating disk mechanical hard drive has at this time? Quite possibly it's more capacity, but maybe we're going to find out. If you've got some knowledge on the subject, first-hand, second-hand, third-hand, let us know about it. Give us a call, let us right now, K2LAW listening.
Or why would it perhaps have something to do with the read-write cycles and the number of read-write cycles that are capable in the licensing unit?
I have heard that one, that your flash drive has a finite number of times you can write and rewrite a particular section before it becomes flaky. And I suspect that a properly operating hard drive can be rewritten an extremely large number of times. Just as long as the inside of the disk stays clean and the head continues to float a few microns above the disk surface, no physical contact takes place, then in theory you could write and rewrite zillions and zillions of times. Whereas the method by which flash memory works, I have the impression it is finite in the number of times you can rewrite it, and I'm having, occasionally I hear words that it's finite in lifetime. In other words, a flash memory where you store some good data in it today, if you come back 5 years from now, will that data still be there with the same error rate? Or will some of it have become volatile? Is a darn interesting question. Maybe there's any further information, please give us your call letters, K2LIW and the TechNet. We don't seem to have a lot of people with that particular knowledge right here tonight, Steve. My son will be back in the house in a few hours, and I'll ask him. He claims to be a bit of a computer maven. He's particularly a Linux enthusiast, and as I said, he owns some hardware that contains solid-state memory. So the advantages and disadvantages, maybe my son Chris will be able to tell us. One last call. Anyone out there knowing why we're still primarily using mechanical hard drives as opposed to purely electronic memory techniques? Give us your call letters. Looks like you win the prize for tonight, Steve. I think you've stumped the group that has assembled so far. And I think later on in the net we should re-ask your question and see if anyone else comes along and spent more smarts on that one. Back to you, Steve, for any final comments. KC2MDP. You stump the group. KC2RIW. You get the free dinner for you and your lady friend. Mel's going to pay for that. You better, Steve.
Very good, Dick. Now, I don't think I stumped the group, that's for sure. It's just a question that came up, you know, time to time. Is, you know, every time I go into the computer store, you see these little, you know, electronic drives, you know, and they get cheaper and cheaper, and the capacity of them gets more and more. So I'm saying to myself, you know, how come they don't use them to replace the old hard drives in the computers? Or even, you know, I have one of these DVRs, a digital video recorder, and I think I've went through three machines already with hard drive failures, and I was just curious why you know, they have these electronics. Well, you know, maybe later on we'll get the question answered. I'm sure we will. Back to you.
That's 2F. Something 2F. Give us your full call if you've got information on that subject. After you give us your name, proceed with that information, sir.
Okay, WF2N. So I'm going through the Selden machine, Dick. How's that?
When I give enough delay, I'm hearing you very well, Paul. Go right ahead.
Okay. Fine. Mr. Dick. I don't know the reason why they haven't switched over. I do know NASA was this flash memory, you know, all their robotic missions are equipped with this flash memory. You'll hear about it. I mean, sometimes it just doesn't have enough of it. I know they have problems with Spirit Opportunity. The flash memory was overloaded, and
had too much of it in there, and they had problems in the beginning, and it spent quite a bit of time, you know, clearing, making room. So my guess is they just don't have enough room. And as far as if it's going to be around for how long, years later, I don't know. I know the flash memory seems to be working pretty good for going on 5 years for Spirit and Opportunity. But NASA loves it. So that's my only comment, Dick. Back to you. WS Prime.
KC2OJO with the comment.
KC2OJO. I think I've heard from you once before. Just tell me your name again and proceed with your comment, sir.
The name is Howard. And I think it's probably 90% economic because look in the advertisements. You can get a flash memory 4 gigabytes, and it probably runs you about $20. So that's roughly maybe 20 gigabytes per $100. But for $100, you can get a small drive that'll fit in a laptop that won't have 20 gigabytes and have 250 gigabytes. So it's a ratio maybe 12 to 1 in cost. If you're just looking at the cost, at least retail. Back to you,
Dick. That's a logical sounding answer, Howard. Howard, I sense that you work with computers quite a bit, or at least are an enthusiast. When it comes to the cost advantage right now that you have in bit per dollar, so to speak, with hard drives, and because mankind tends to move in the direction of less and less mechanical parts, because when properly done, surely electronic, non-moving parts tend to eventually be more reliable. So the advantage that we have right now for hard drives, do you have a rough guess as to the rate at which that is changing? Would you guess, for instance, the break-even point might take place 2 or 3 years from now? I'm asking for a guess, an estimate. We won't hold you to it, Howard. KC2O, OJO, K2RIW.
Dick, what I, not from my own opinion, I've seen in print that possibly 5 years from now there might be a crossover, but it's very strange that every time people have said day of the hard drive was over, somehow they've managed to pack more and more data on. But certainly within about 5 years, I'm sure that we'll get at least as much money out of the solid state drive as in the hard drive. It's just how much ahead will the hard drive move by then. Back to you. KC2OJO.
Solid state drive exists? Yeah, there are laptop computers, for instance, you can buy that have no moving part in the hard drive or the hard drive equivalent. Purely solid state. A little bit pricey, but they do exist. And what Howard is bringing to our attention is the fact that in dollars per bit, we're still way ahead of the game with hard drives, mechanical moving type thing. We've got a lot of history with that one. We've got it down to quite a science, and they're going to be around a while. My guess is if someone is predicting 5 years, maybe it's going to take 4 years. The time may happen a little bit sooner. But I see a possibility of eliminating mechanical devices because they tend to be, in the past, a little bit less reliable. Anyone have any further comments on this? Give me a call that is right now. Okay. Greg was the next person who signed in, KC2QQA. And if you're in Manitoba, I should be able to hear you pretty loud on the input. Go right ahead, Greg. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, I have a unit for SD102, and I purchased it and it got shipping damage. They didn't protect the VFO knob, so it kind of got pushed into the front of the radio. I can pull it out, and I believe that knob works on a 6-to-1 ratio. And what I'm worried about, I didn't even test it yet, but I'm worried that I'm going to have a 33 KC like slash sound coming through as I tune it, if I do turn it on and get it working properly. If that happens, is there anything that you could do to eliminate that, or if they just bend that thing, I guess it's pretty much over.
Yeah, the FT-102 Yates, I think you said, has a smash in the main tuning knob in the front. And you said it's got a 6-to-1 ratio to it. That amazes me. Because I thought nowadays a high percentage of the rigs have a optical shaft encoder connected to the main tuning knob. They're not really mechanically moving anything. They're moving a disc that's got a whole bunch of little stripe marks on it with a clear piece of plastic. And it's red with an optical shaft encoder. That's what I thought many rigs are these days. So give me a little bit more feedback. And by the way, the FT-102, I should know, is that a fairly modern rig or not so modern rig, Greg? KC-2-2QA, K2RIW in the check net.
Dick, it's vintage about 1980 or 79 until we use the regular VFO.
Okay, yep. Rich, give us a few more words. So does it have a 6-to-1 reduction between the main tuning knob and the VFO? Is the VFO a great big variable capacitor? And so, well, you've done quite a few pieces of repair or things like that. I bet you've seen that actual internal mechanism. So picture it being smashed in from the front panel, and what's your guess as to the internal damage, and do you think it's repairable without Greg going to a great big price of replacing a whole lot of hardware? Do you think you can get good operation back? N2EO, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick. The problem is getting the parts. The Japanese haven't been backing up the stuff, even on the new gear, the older gear. So I don't know what the ratio on the planetary time is, but probably the tuning capacitor is going to have to be replaced. Now, whether that's available from Yaesu, I don't know. And if it damaged the front panel, I doubt that's available. What he may have to do is get a junker, a carcass, and pull the parts out of that. And maybe he's going to do that, even if they have the parts. And probably they don't. I remember the radio, it used 3 tubes in the output, I think they were 146. Kind of an unusual radio. It's one of the few radios that use the output to detect you.
N2FLS comments.
N2FLS. Go right ahead, sir. And start with your name. I should know it.
How you doing, Dick? My name is Mark. N2FLS. Hey, Rich. How you doing?
I didn't catch the full question for the
one with the 102. There's a Yaesu FT-102 group on Yahoo, okay? And also there's a guy down in Florida. His name is Mal, and he's pretty much the world's expert on the FT-102. He has rebuilt literally thousands of them, and that's the only radio he works on. And although the radio was from the early 80s, the receiver in that particular radio rivals pretty much the state-of-the-art stuff today. Of course, it doesn't have digital stuff, but it's quite an impressive radio. Give Mal an email. I think his call is N4CL, I think it is. I guess I'm checking that out right now. I'll get back to you on that. But I'm sure he has all the parts that you need, or he might even fix things for you. Yes, Mal, NC4L, that's his name. Dick?
Hey, that's a darn good piece of information there, Mark. Thank you. For NC4L, Mal, in Florida, FT-102 repair expert. Yeah, what Greg, KC2QQA, was telling us is that his FT-102 was shipped and improperly boxed, and the front panel main knob got shoved in. It's a 6-to-1 reduction knob into the VFO assembly. And he's asking questions about what's required to fix it, and sounds like Mal's the right man. Thank you for any further comments on this one, Mark. N2FLS, K2RIW, the tech net.
Okay, N2FLS, picking it up in the group.
Yeah, he's a heart specialist down there, if I remember correctly. I spoke to him a couple of years ago. He's a very nice guy. And you can probably give him a call during normal hours, you know, before, I guess, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, because he's very busy. And he will probably tell you what to do, or at least give you a helping hand. Like I said, he rebuilds these things for people. You know, that particular radio had a relay problem here and there, where the relays, you know, they get flaky. They don't really make contact properly. He has relays for this thing. He gold plates the relay contacts, and just the radio comes back better than new, you know, working wise. It's quite remarkable. But I recall reading his shipping instructions on shipping that radio to him, and one of the requests was take the rubber feet off the bottom, and I believe it was take the main tuning knob off the radio, because the shippers love to drop these things. And that's pretty much it. But check into that FT-102 Yahoo group, and join. You know, nothing doesn't cost you anything. Just do it up, and there's tons of people on there who love that radio. Dick?
Well done, Mark. Sounds like one of these radios where people really develop an emotional attachment to it. An oldie but goodie. Reminds me a little bit of the Kenwood 520 or 840 series, I think it is. One of my favorites is the Drake R4C. These are radios that will remain in infamy because they perform so well for their time. The poor man's Collins of that particular day. So it sounds like you've got a good radio there, Greg, and by way of battle, I'll bet you're going to get what you want. Now, with our hindsight, we can find out that that radio should not be shipped without removing the knob from the front panel or without packing a, you know, very specific foam on that front panel with a hole for the for that knob to make sure that when it gets dropped, it doesn't get stressed. We're older but smarter as time goes on, Greg. KC2 QQA, K2RIW in the tech net.
I have a few optimized radios. Actually, look me up on QLV, and you'll see that the 102 is. I have a picture of my station up there. But take a look at QLV, you'll get a kick out of it. But I always love that radio, too. It's a 225-output radio, basically, if you load it right. And you put the W tubes in there, not the B's. You put the W's in there, a little more heavy duty. But Matt was the best guy. It's just that he has like a one-year waiting list. So I was like, and he said there's nothing you could do about that. It is a 6-to-1 ratio. I just figured maybe one of you guys would know, like a quick shortcut. Mal doesn't take any shortcuts. Everything's got to be 100%, or he won't touch it. So I figured maybe you guys knew a little trick or something like that. But hey, listen, thank you very much. You guys have been very informative, and I'll catch you guys later. KC2QQA, I'll be listening to the rest of the TechNet, hopefully.
Now, I built a piece of equipment a zillion years ago that has a National, or is it Millen? I think it's National. It's the brand name of the 4-to-1, 6-to-1, something like that, knob on the front panel for the VFO. And so that reduction mechanism built into other front panel dial mechanisms might already exist. And if that's what's broken, maybe that part would be replaceable. And even if the rotary dial you replace it with, the reduction mechanism, happens to be 5-to-1 or 7-to-1 ratio instead of 6-to-1, as long as the main indicator moves with the shaft of the VFO shaft, and maybe it can work out correctly. I know that some radio they have on the fast-moving dial on the outside, 1 KC mark. And yes, that could be a little bit troublesome. But to a mechanically smart person, there may be some substitutes you can find with these front panel mechanisms that you can buy for the homebrew crowd. I think I see them advertised in QST from time to time. Good luck with that project, Greg. Let us know how it turns out. Come on back and tell us, even if it's good or bad, what the results are. Let's see. Let me turn it over to Paul, WS2N. First of all, did I skip anyone who signed in with a yes so far? If so, give me a call letters right now. K2LIW.
Dick, I have a follow-up question after you take Paul and CDLs.
Okay. Paul, I did read a report this week. I wish I remember the name of the spacecraft that's soon going to be launched, in which they're going to be investigating the layer above the optical surface of the sun, which really has a strong magnetic field that issues the solar wind and mass ejection clouds that come out of the sun. So the spacecraft they're going to launch to investigate that. You probably have more thoughts on that one than I do. I made the mistake of not making a copy of that particular report. I think it was a NASA report that I was reading. But the US-2N, what's going on in space these days, Paul? K2LIW in the second half.
Okay, Dick. I'm not sure which one that is. The Ace was big, the ELF was big, Ulysses was big. New one. I'll have to research that one, Dick. I don't know the new one that's going to research the sun. European Space Agency was really big on that. I wonder if you... Is it an American mission? Because most of these missions are all jointly run, these robotic missions now. But I wonder if it's a NASA launch or it's just one from French Guiana, by the European Space Agency, Dick, or maybe even a Russian launch. Dick, back to you.
And now that you bring it to my memory, there's a good chance it was the European Space Agency spacecraft. But a joint spacecraft. Oh, I do remember seeing a long list of countries that were contributing to it, and the United States is on that list. Long list of countries that are all contributing to this particular effort. But they're discovering that the magnetic fields of the sun are where the real action is taking place. Those magnetic fields extend considerably above the visual surface. There's another ionized layer that's transparent, which does show up in ultraviolet, and the spacecraft is going to be observing above our atmosphere in ultraviolet, which doesn't penetrate our atmosphere very well, and therefore really make quantitative measurements of what this upper layer is doing with the magnetic field that it contains, which does the mass ejection that we hear about from time to time. Back to you, Paul. And is there anything else going on in space this week? I presume the launch of the space shuttle that's going to do the Hubble repair, I'd like to believe that that's still on schedule. And I think that's only a couple of months away from US-2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's in October. And, that solar mission, most of the solar missions, they put out a Lagrange point. It's probably going to be one of those. And I know that's usually, about a million miles out. So it tends not to really orbit the Earth well. If you want to call it orbiting once a year, that's what it really is. But it stays at the one position. It's probably one of those deals. Most of the solar missions are. STS 120, 126, or 125, I believe it is, the Hubble repair mission, October. And I know, the reason I asked was I know there aren't too many scheduled missions for Florida. They have a lunar mission they put back that they want to get a military launch off. But that was supposed to go off at the end of 08, and that one's going to go off in 09. It's going to survey the moon like never done before in a polar orbit. Really super detail. They'll know exactly where to land all future spacecraft that they send up there.
So, nothing really to add. I know Phoenix Mission's going on the operation, but nothing new lately that I've come across. So I'll turn it back to you, Dick, this is WS2M.
Very fine. Thank you, Paul. Joe, you got the floor.
Thank you, Dick. I heard one of the news programs I listened to occasionally, I think it's like Fox News, they said NASA is possibly considering keeping the Shuttle program running for another 5 years. Have you heard any rumor about that?
I've been predicting something like that has to take place, Joe, because they want to discontinue the shuttle use, but the replacement for the shuttle is not going to be in existence for a number of years beyond that point. So therefore, there's a big gap in between in which the new spaceship, the new shuttle replacement is not there, the old one is discontinued, and we're at the complete mercy of Soviet launches. And I'm reasonably sure that the astronauts that have come back on a Soviet Soyuz craft are not completely happy with the project, with that method of coming back home. It's a fairly rough ride. It lands on land. It's not a real aircraft. It's a parachute landing on land, and it's not a comfortable ride on the way home. So it doesn't surprise me that it's eventually going to be talk of extending the current shuttle uses, I think, because to have no launch capability of our own, which means no backup capability, if there was a failure of a Soyuz, you have an onboard emergency of the International Space Station and you want to bring people back home in a hurry, to have all your eggs in one basket, only one method of getting back home, you and I can easily see the vulnerability of that. So I've been guessing that they have to either speed up the time at which the new craft is available or slow down the time at which we discontinue the current shuttle. One or the other's got to take place. And even though the shuttle has got its problems, still the bird in hand is worth two in the bush, if you know what I mean. So, what else is new with you, Joe, and how have you been doing with the calibration of your spectrum analyzer? For the A2RYY, A2RYW in the TechNet.
WS, so I put comment on the seating arrangement for the International Space Station.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yes, first of all, I haven't heard that rumor, but I think that would be great. The big problem with the space station is you need as many seats attached to the space station as you have people. So right now you have three people up on station. That means you need three seats. They have one Soyuz craft back there that they could abandon ship. Problem with the space station now, especially that it's not so big, these guys are spending most of their time keeping that space station in operation, doing general house maintenance, and the science is, I mean, whatever's being done is pretty much being done by robotics, where they put things into operation and, you know, let the time go by, but they're not really spending any real science time, or what they would like to. They need at least another three people up there to do that, three to keep it running and three to do real science. So the only way to do it would be to have another, a shuttle or some spacecraft, your future Orion spacecraft, something permanently docked to the space station. The present administration did away with the X-38 that was being built that would have been able to carry up to eight people back in a small space shuttle looking vehicle that would have come through disconnected as a lifeboat and cut through the atmosphere, and they had a parasail, and it was going to land. It looked like they had skis on it, and it would have landed on the ground. It looked like a small space shuttle. That's been completely abandoned. So that was going to be brought up in the back of a space shuttle and then permanently attached to the space station and used only when needed. So, yeah, another 3, 4, 5 years would be good. Back to you, WS2M.
Yeah, makes sense, Paul. So, hey, Paul, next time you write a suggestion to NASA, tell them we as a TechNet recommend that they extend the use of the space shuttle a few more years until the replacement is available. Don't give up what you've got until you've got something that's better. Don't burn your bridge until you've got a good place to go. Hey, Joe, so how are you doing with the calibration of your spectrum analyzer, and what's the latest in your neighborhood? B2RYY, B2RYW.
No comments on that, because I'm not taking anything apart to try to make any measurements yet.
Okay. I think we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. One last call, if there's any other questions you guys want to add. If not, Paul's about to, Mel's about to open the mailbag. So we're going to go to the mail a little bit earlier, like we've been promising over the past week. One last call, if anyone has any further questions or comments. K2RYW of the TechNet.
F2EO.
Ah, yes, I forgot you. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. There's a follow-up question. What I was talking about before was that Waters, B-48, B-37, that's what they used to call a Q-multiplier. And I was reading, I'm a little confused. I was reading the theory of the Q-multiplier, how it works. It uses a term called negative resistance. And I really don't know what negative resistance is. I'm going to take a guess and say it has to do with something with conductance in micromoles or moles, like transconductance, because they use a tube in a Q-multiplier. I don't know if I'm off base or not, but maybe you give me an idea how that thing works, Dick. I've been playing around with a heat model GD125 that I bought inexpensively on eBay. I've got it hooked up to a Collins KWM2A. It has a peak. It has a notch. You can run either the peak or the notch across the pass band of the filter. Works pretty well, but I'm not really sure how it operates. Back to you, Dick. H2RIW at 2EO.
Yeah, I've owned a Q-multiplier, studied it. I think I understand it. Let me make sure now to find out that the one that you own works by a similar process. When you're in the peaking mode, is there a knob on the front panel which is labeled something like feedback or regeneration? That you twist the knob more and more clockwise, you get a more and more narrow peak on the peaking mode of the Q-multiplier, and if you twist it too far, it breaks into oscillation. Is there such a knob on your Q-multiplier? Back to you, Rich.
Yes, there is, Dick. There are two knobs. One is marked notch depth, and the other is marked peak. And yes, it will break into oscillation. It uses a dual triode at 12AX7.
Okay. When you build positive feedback into an amplifying circuit, you're doing it for two or three different purposes. In the old days, we used to try to get as much gain as possible out of a tube, and because tubes were expensive, you didn't want to use too many of them. On the old-fashioned TRF, tuned radio frequency type receivers, before super regens were invented, when you've got a local oscillator and mixer and first IF, the advantage of a super regen is not only that your gain is at a much lower frequency built into the IF, and that's much less expensive gain than RF gain. Second of all, is that some stages of RF gain, some stages of IF gain, therefore you're not putting all of your gain on one particular frequency, which starts pushing the state of the art as far as isolation between the stages or shielding between the stages so you don't break into oscillation. But in the early days of TRF radios, with either regen or super regen, and they're kind of different. But regen, you would take some of the output of an amplifying stage, feed it back to the input as if you were building an oscillator. But you control the amount of feedback. When you make the feedback gain, in other words, the forward gain through the tube plus the loss of the feedback network and the point of injection, when you make that loop gain less than unity, it will not oscillate, but it has the Q-multiplier characteristic. The fact that there is tuning there, which is sending the signal around that loop multiple times through that filter, an IF filter that's associated with that stage. Because you're sending the signal through multiple times, you could say you're getting the tuning equivalent of a number of cascaded stages of filtering. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that every oscillator has feedback that brings you beyond unity gain. That's why it breaks into oscillation. And anything with oscillation capability by way of feedback, from the point of view of the crystal or the tuned network that's setting the frequency, if you put some kind of impedance measuring network onto the terminals of the crystal, at the frequency where the crystal is resonating, the network when it's set up properly in an oscillator, you will look into an impedance of your circuit from the two pins of the crystal. You unplug the crystal, you plug in your test equipment at those two socket points, and make a measurement. And you, under normal circumstances, would expect to see a certain passband filter characteristic and a certain impedance. You calculate that impedance of any operating oscillator, and you'll find out the impedance is negative. Okay? When it comes to a 1-ohm resistor sitting on the table, and you put your ohm meter close to it,
we have repeater, timeout,
a 1-ohm resistor sitting on the table with the leads of my ohm meter connected across it, that's a very understandable circuit. Put 1 volt across it, you know it'll draw 1 ampere. We understand what 1 ohm of positive resistance is. Electronically, you can generate 1 ohm of negative resistance. You're about to ask, what does it do? Well, it's got gain. Yeah, that's great. If you started off with 1 volt, you put a 1 volt battery across it, you would expect it to draw 1 ampere. It will, but the direction of the current flow is opposite of what you expect. Your 1 volt battery that you put across that 1 ohm resistor would have 1 ampere flowing, but the 1 ampere would be charging your battery. Not discharging it, charging it. Under normal circumstances, with an ordinary battery and an ordinary 1 ohm resistor, if the resistor goes up in value, the voltage coming out of your battery still being the same, the current goes down. Or conversely, if the voltage out of your battery goes down, the current decreases in a positive resistor. In the case of a negative resistor, if your battery, the 1 volt battery in my example that you're connecting across this 1 ohm negative resistance, if your battery starts behaving like it has a higher internal resistance, instead of it being a voltage drop, an ordinary battery under heavy current would start coming down from 1 volt, put out 9, 10, 8, 10, 7, 10 as it discharges. In this particular case, the negative resistor is charging your battery, and so the 1 volt will climb to 1.1, 1.2, and the current might also increase in the process. It's a runaway condition. It's obviously a negative resistance, obviously has gain. It is supplying energy. Now, the Q multiplier has got a real tube with real gain and a power supply connected to it. So at the 455 KC or 9 megacycles, whatever frequency is running at, it is a negative resistance. It's got gain, and it would charge your external circuit. It literally, you could say, charges your crystal. Crystal that does the resonating if there was one in the oscillator circuit. So circuits with real gain can have what is called negative resistance. A tunnel diode under certain bias conditions has negative resistance. Let me drop. So that when you change the voltage across the diode by increasing it, and you would expect the current to also increase, the current will decrease. When you actually look at a curve tracer plot of a tunnel diode, it starts off at zero current at 0 volts. It rises at, depending on how you set up the graph, at a 45-degree angle, current going up vertically as voltage goes up horizontally. And now, at a certain point, you reach the peak of the hill, so to speak, and it starts going back down. For higher voltage, the current goes back down in a certain region of a tunnel diode. When you bias it into that region, because the current goes down for the voltage going up, it is a negative resistance. The slope of that line on that plot is equal to the number of ohms of resistance. And if the slope is a negative going slope instead of a positive going slope, we call it a negative resistance. It is capable of oscillating, it's capable of supplying gain. The positive feedback that you adjust with that peaking control is supplying the feedback when you're getting to the edge near oscillation. And so that's why they call it negative resistance. It is a real negative resistance at the point that you make it oscillate. When you're backed off a little bit from oscillation, you haven't quite reached negative resistance, but you got very close to it. And under those conditions, you get a very sharp tuning and you get some extra gain. Maybe that helps a little bit. What really goes on in a feedback network of a regen receiver, and that's what a Q multiplier is a stage of a receiver that is a regen stage. It has its advantages and its disadvantages. You'll notice that sometimes it gives you a ringing characteristic. You notice there are times when you have it set just right and you're listening to a weak signal, and along comes a strong signal, and it behaves in a crazy way. At least the Q multiplier that I use for Eastkit did do that. I wonder if you've seen some of those not-so-perfect characteristics there, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW in the deck man.
Yeah, K2KEY is giving you the whole story on it.
Okay. Let me let Rich say a couple of words, and he's going to turn it over to Mel. Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Dick, that was really good. I do understand what you're saying. I follow it. I want to digest it, but I do follow what you're saying about negative resistance. We touched on it when I was in school, but I really didn't understand it fully. Now I think I have a better grip on it. You know, so let me turn it over to Mel and see what he's got to say. By the way, I haven't noticed any real instability in that GD125. It actually works pretty well. I installed it and thought I might have instability problems, oscillation. It's really quite good. Over to you, Mel, N2EO.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that you've got a much better regulated power supply. In the case of the Eastkit Q multiplier that was on my Eastkit AR3 kit receiver, a half megacycle to 30 megacycle included receiver that I built way back in 1956, it didn't have regulated power supply. So I could set the Q multiplier to a desirable condition, and somebody would turn off a major appliance in the house, the voltage go up a little bit, and my Q multiplier would break into oscillation. A modern-day Q multiplier probably has a real good regulated power supply to stop that kind of jazz. You got it, Mel. Play for the beat.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Okay, I know that unit quite well. I homebrewed a number of them way back. And I'll give you a very simple explain the Q multiplier to you. Maybe you'll get a little bit more understanding on it. The Q multiplier, as Eastkit produced it, or the one way it was originally described, the original version of it, the homebrew version, is actually basically a stable regenerative stage that is connected in parallel with one of your IF stages of the receiver. Okay? So, one condition that you set it up, it actually will narrow the bandwidth. And the other condition, it produces a sharp null, or what we call a rejection notch. Now, so when you tune the controls on there, you can control the frequency of the peak or the null. And depending on the receiver, that is, of course, the speed used, the null is actually basically what we call a single tuned circuit. But the Q of it is usually adjustable over a wide range. So a Q multiplier was most effective at an IF of about 500 kilohertz. In other words, the 455K kilohertz IF were basically what they were meant for. The Q multiplier basically, it produced it, was for some of the less expensive receivers. And you had to be careful with them because on some of the less expensive receivers, they had what they were known as a oscillating IF station for the BFO. And if you use it, that type of receiver, they just do not work well. In other words, it was never really meant for CW or FFB. Back to you, Dick. What do you think? Right, or should I go on with this? Over.
Yeah, my Heathkit AR3 receiver, when I was first using it as a novice on the 40-meter and 80-meter band, 80-meter in particular, the novice portion would have, across the IF bandwidth, all 10 or 15 CW signals pounding away simultaneously. And to try to pick out one of those as an unskilled operator, for me, was very difficult. I added the Q multiplier. I could choose one of those CW signals, peak him up, and null out, almost null out all the others by comparison. Peaked that one guy up, he came through nice and strong, and now the Morse code reception of that one guy, as long as he's not drifting, as long as my receiver is not drifting, worked out very well. Yes, I never used the Q multiplier in the sideband reception. That holds on Heathkit AR3 receiver really wasn't set up for sideband reception. It had a B frequency oscillator. You turn the RF gain down real low, turn the audio gain up real high, set the BFO just right. You could get sideband reception. Not very high fidelity, but it sort of worked. But that's not quite the way you used it when you were listening to Morse code. And so the Q multiplier in the Morse code mode worked like a charm. I'm pretty sure I never used the Q multiplier in the peaking mode for AM reception. I probably did use it for a notch filter when listening to an AM signal, when you have a nearby a guy that's giving you a header diacrism. You know, somebody comes up on channel, he's tuning up his transmitter while you're in the middle of a QSO with a bunch of guys in a round table, and the Q multiplier in the notch mode would do a pretty good job in that case, notching out that one guy that's doing the tuning. And I think that was a twin T notch filter when you set it up that way. And I think there was, yes, there was a notch depth control. When you set it to the right number, it would give you a very deep notch, 20, 30, 40 dB, as I remember. I don't think I used that Q multiplier in the last 40 years. That was way back in the dark ages, Mel. K2KEY, when did you last use the Q multiplier? And was it on a Collins receiver, K2LIW in the second half?
Well, not quite. The Collins receiver. Back to the dark ages. Yeah, you hit upon a very interesting thing about the Q multiplier. There was later circuits that were published. They never were, went into production with Heathkit and all. But this was getting towards the end of that type of era. And that was, like you say, a T-notch filter. The T-notch filter, however, basically was worked only well on receivers that had a 50 to 100 kilohertz intermediate frequency IF, it had, like you say, it had a control called the depth control. It was, like I say, added on as another add-on gadget to a receiver. Basically, the original Q multiplier circuit was designed for a receiver called the BT-453, which was a World War II receiver that came on the war surplus by the ton, and that's when the guy started, the hams got a hold of it and started tweaking it, and the original design, like of the Q multiplier, was a homebrew project, and he just picked up on and copied it exactly. And as I say, in the later version, the last version, which Heathkit did not go into production, was the adding of a T-notch filter. So it was a whole IF. It was actually adding an IF circuit with a T-notch, because it had to work between 50 and 100 kilohertz. That was basically the derivation of this system, Dick, over.
I'm waiting for the D. Maybe we're not going to get one right now. One good thing for people to remember, no matter what receiver you're using, most of the receivers you can touch these days are super heterodyne, one conversion or two conversions. The very last IF strip is usually 455 KT or something close by. Or if there's a second IF strip, sometimes we get down to numbers like 50 kHz. But it doesn't take a great deal of circuitry to add a Q multiplier, a homebrew Q multiplier, to those circuits. And that is a interesting approach to get a very narrow filter. If, for instance, you're a Morse code enthusiast, you can go out and spend a whole lot of money for a very narrow crystal filter and install it in your receiver. But if the receiver is an older one, where the narrow crystal filters or a mechanical equivalent is no longer available, and there's a number of good receivers out there where, unless you're real lucky, you can't find those new filters. So the filters that you want to add are no longer in production. So for a guy to homebrew a Q multiplier, it's got a lot going for it. Gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. Because the nice thing about the Q multiplier is, as you adjust the peaking control, you can set the bandwidth in a continuous manner, anything from a couple of kilohertz all the way down to something like 50 hertz. Just by turning that knob, the bandwidth continuously becomes more and more narrow, up to the point where you push the knob for the peaking control too far, which is controlling the amount of positive feedback at that stage, and it will eventually break into oscillation. So the Q multiplier, with that very simple circuitry, is the equivalent of about five different crystal filters. Each one of those crystal filters may cost you $100, and you can build a whole darn Q multiplier for probably $40 worth of parts. And as I said, it's depending on how you use it, it is a tunable IF filter. You can adjust the frequency up and down. And as such, when you adjust the frequency of the Q multiplier, you are not changing the frequency of the tone you're listening to. If you're listening to a guy who's giving you a tone of 600 hertz, as you adjust the Q multiplier, you'll first peak up 400 hertz, then 500 hertz, then 600 hertz. In other words, the tone